Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
You are. And today we are joined by Chad Cully, and we're going to talk about agroforestry, or I think I'll weed this garden in about 15 years or so. Now that second title, since I don't know anything about what we're talking about, I figured...
Well, I'm glad you admit it.
This show is not unusual. I figured I'd just throw that in because it felt like fun. But anyway, so Chad was formerly with the Cincinnati Zoo. He's now a graduate student in what field, Chad, are you studying?
Natural resources
at Cornell, even though you didn't want me to toot your horn on that, but I find it impressive. So I'll mention it anyway. So,
well, I just want to say Chad's been with us for a couple of other podcasts in case people want to check that out. And I was hoping you'd remember more about it than you seem to. It just doesn't stick in your brain.
I recognize him in a crowd. That's close enough.
Okay, good. Good to know. So Chad, today we're going to talk about something that's super exciting to both of us. And so if I'm talking too much, say, whoa, Annie, I got something to say. But you're working in agroforestry, even though you say your master's degree is going to be in natural resources. But it seems like agroforestry is a very sort of niche kind of topic right now, and especially since I know there are tons and tons of people in many states that own forest land, but they don't really know what to do with it other than to clear cut it. So I'm anxious to hear what you think agroforestry really means.
You know what? I'm just going to read a definition from Ken Mudge's book. So Ken Mudge is from Cornell, and I think his definition of agroforestry fits really well. So he says it's the combination of crops, plants, animals, fungi, and trees in a forest-inspired agricultural systems that benefit human communities through greater connection to the landscape, improved stewardship of resources, and enhanced economic opportunities.
Okay, so. You lost me. You lost me after Cornell. So,
come on.
Well, I like the first sentence because that appeals to my definition of what I like to do when I grow things, is that I want to feed and nurture and protect all of the things that are alive within the soil. And, bad bugs make for good food for good bugs and things like that. So I've been reading a book called Wildlife Gardening by a man named John V. Dennis. And it was written in 1985, but he's an English guy, so some of the stuff may not directly apply. But it's really fascinating to hear his take on how different wildlife utilizes nature's space and the seeds and what they eat first and what they eat second as the snow starts to fall and all that stuff. And that strikes me that applies, that fits with agroforestry as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a real opportunity to create biodiversity. It may be a little artificial in some ways, but at the end of the day, if we can create an opportunity for more insects to live, that means more birds and, maybe bigger mammals beyond that. So yeah, it's a thing.
I know with silvopasture, that's a fascinating technique that maybe you could talk a little bit about, but I know that there were some studies done in England where they took land, these big gentrified places, they owned a lot of land and they weren't able to make a living off the land. And so they decided to revert back to what we today would call silvopasture. And they went from almost being bankrupt to actually making a living on these giant estates because they were doing a lot more of creating biodiversity. And
well, what is silvopasture?
Chad's going to tell us.
Oh, tell me, Chad.
Yeah, so that's basically grazing livestock underneath the canopy of a bunch of trees. So I know on your property in particular, my hope is that when we plant some trees out there that eventually, I don't know, I mean, none of us will probably be alive for this, but Eventually, those trees get big enough that somebody might be able to finish some hogs on walnuts and chestnuts. Excuse me, walnuts and chestnuts that we're planting in 2020, but you know, it might be until 2040 until somebody's able to do that. But we're going to give it a shot.
Is that one of the obstacles in all of this? Because you just said we're not going to be alive to reap the benefits. So it seems to me farmers are usually like, how much can I earn this season, as opposed to thinking about long term?
Sure. I'm exaggerating, of course, but
no, maybe not. Maybe you'll still be alive.
Yeah.
I hope so.
It's certainly a challenge. I think the real question is, you know, as far as that challenge goes, who is going to step up and, you know, put their money where their mouth is. And so I guess, this is my own personal interpretation, but I kind of wonder if maybe cities, people who are living in cities, might need to help out a bit by providing some resources for people in rural areas to experiment with this kind of stuff. Because it's true that maybe, especially with trees, you know, it might be 10, 15, 20 years before you start to see reliable crops of nuts. And then, you know, of course, then you get your first crack at running some hogs underneath these things. And you know, how much money do you make? I don't know. I think that's a big question right now. So,
but lots of people,
short-term. Go ahead.
Well, lots of people own forest land that could be turned into silver pasture. Because it almost comes down to the singular fact of being able to afford enough fencing. And also in silver pasture, they do a lot of rotating of livestock into different zones within that pasturing area. And I think, you know, these are things that, like alley cropping, I know that's one of the things that we wanted to talk about today, but I was thinking alley cropping could work very well in a lot of parks and even in green spaces in older parts of cities where they have this big median down the center that often has trees, or they have the houses back up to some green space. I mean, we just haven't efficiently used the spaces that we have. It's all just been there like to grow lawn, which is just absolutely insane. So talk a little bit about alley cropping and then the difference between a forest farm and a forest garden.
So I think you raise a great point, because I think a lot of these sort of subdivisions of agroforestry. So there's sort of, loosely speaking, like six different practices within agroforestry. One of them is alley cropping, as you said. The other one would be riparian buffers. Another one, silvopasture, windbreaks, forest farming, and forest gardening. But alley cropping, I do think, as far as incorporating these ideas into urban environments, I think it's a great idea. So it may not be what in a rural area we would call alley cropping, but it could be something that really looks and feels a lot like alley cropping, and we could do that in the city, you know, maybe in a median, like you said.
What is alley cropping, Chad?
Yeah, so that's basically, it's going to be planting a bunch of trees just in straight lines. And then, you know, so you might have, say, peach trees and chestnut trees, you know, one after, or every other tree, rather. And then maybe underneath those, you'd plant something, you know, much smaller, maybe vegetables of some sort, or I don't know, blueberries, something like that, but in straight lines. So, you know, I guess the idea there would be that you could get tractors or heavy equipment in between the trees. So you might even plant hay in between the trees, or soy. So forest farming and forest gardening, basically, as far as I can tell, the difference between the two, you know, forest farming is if you have trees on your property already existing, you could maybe try to farm underneath those existing trees, and that's your forest farming. Forest gardening, on the other hand, might be a little bit more akin to what Annie and I are doing, which is basically taking a blank slate and we're going to try and mimic the ecology of your existing forest there on your property and basically plant something that's going to produce, it's going to produce something for us, hopefully some kind of economy, or maybe just food if that's all we can get out of it. But you know, we're going to do our darndest.
we're going to create economy for sure. So just one more thing. Can you explain riparian buffers also for Jay, who's not a farmer?
I even know what riparian means. Okay. What do you know?
Oh my God. You're scaring me.
Uh-huh. It's basically planting trees and shrubs or maybe even grasses between, farm fields and water bodies. But that could be between, you know, between streets or homes in the urban area and water bodies as well. I don't think it doesn't need to be just between agriculture and a water body. But that's just to help kind of clean up the water a bit before it gets to, say, the Ohio River or the ocean.
And this keeps some of the disturbed soil from just washing into the river or the lake?
Absolutely, yeah, that too, and of course you'd be trapping carbon a bit in the soil by doing that as well, so yeah.
And in some cases, like with willow, it actually feeds the fish if it's planted in a way that the leaves and things can fall into the body of water. It really does support fish life. So anyway, the other thing before we get into the heart of the agroforestry talking is you and I have had a lot of discussion about native plants versus any old plant. So we wouldn't plant in Ohio, we wouldn't go around planting bird of paradise because it's not native and it's eventually not going to grow because it gets too cold. But then how does all that native versus non-native play into creating biodiversity?
Yeah, we don't want to disturb the existing ecology as much as possible. So planting anything that is going to get out into your woodlot and become, we'll say, selfish, like
kudzu. Invasive.
Yeah.
Invading.
Like kudzu is a great example of that. In your area, Rose of Sharon, and here we have
Floribunda rose is really bad. In the 40s, they introduced that. It was hedge so they could have fence row.
Exactly, yeah. Honeysuckle, but those things, you know, are not used by our native insects or our native birds, maybe, or mammals. So it really wreaks havoc on the local ecology. So we are not going to plant anything on your property that's non-native unless we know for sure it's not going to get out. It's not going to, you know, run wild. So I think that's, you know, it's really important. I don't want to say that we can't plant anything that's non-native, but we need to be careful. We got to be really choosy about what non-native plants we plant.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be invasive here, and I'm going to remind everybody that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, joined today by Chad Cully, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
All right. So I'm no longer invasive. I am now native.
Oh, well, that's another story. So the one thing that I was thinking about as you were finishing up there was, in my mind, you know, there are two bits in the idea of creating biodiversity and through agrotourism, agrotourism, agroforestry. And one is the fact that we don't want to grow things that are going to invade and choke out other native plants that are important. But also, we want to consider that insects and wildlife need to eat. And if we're growing things that are not things they would normally eat, they may adjust to that. but a lot of them might die in the process if you're going to wipe out a bunch of plants that they would normally eat to grow something that doesn't really belong there. That said, we talked about growing figs, which are not native to this area, but humans love to eat figs. So, and I think coons do too, because some coons have come and taken a few of the figs off of one of my fig trees. But I think humans would like to eat those. And I also know they would bring a pretty price in selling them. So we want to make money. We'll be capitalists when we have to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know any particular stories about figs becoming invasive in this area, so I'm not going to tell you not to plant those.
Oh, good. Good, because we want to experiment and see how it goes. So,
but so I mean, that kind of stuff is subject to change, though. So, you know, be ready.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's just gardening. You know, you realize a plant's not doing well there, or it doesn't look right, or whatever the reason, you always reserve the right to move it, kill it, or expand it. So explain about how to begin a forest garden where there's no forest. What's the first step, and what do we do from that point?
The first step in our case has been to kind of inventory the trees that are growing native to your property, or the type of forest. I believe in your case, it's mostly beech and hickory. There's a lot of sycamore or walnut. So we know, roughly speaking, what we're dealing with. And then, you know, we're going to go about trying to pick out some plants that aren't going to become invasive in your area. And also something, as you've said, that are going to, you know, produce something for you. So I started to choose some plants that I've been growing myself for a while and have some experience with. And then we went out there this past week and stood in the field and, you know, kind of gave it the eyeball test and thought about where we could fit a tree that's going to grow maybe 70 feet tall and 40 feet wide, for example. And where are we going to put 40 of those? And then something right next to it that's almost just as big, another 40 of those. So it's a test in spatial reasoning at the design level.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would say too is that what you're really describing is we're setting goals. So we had some dreams that we were talking about, and it all comes back to that biodiversity piece where we're looking at what kind of insects and wildlife do we want to attract, and what do we need to do with the soil, and also what kind of investment are we going to have to make if we can't propagate the plants, and you know, and how are these things going to create income or not create income? And so we talked a lot about that too, and that's for another program, because I would like us to move on. So there's lots more to talk about, so you'll have to come back again. But I'd like us to talk about the real reason that we're creating this forest garden, and that comes back to one topic, and that's climate change. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because you're feeling pretty passionate about it.
Absolutely. I think this is the real kind of crux of it. The reason to do this sort of thing is because maybe, just maybe, we can, you know, start to get rid of some, well, I don't want to say we want to get rid of grasses, because grasses can be great, but we need to plant more trees in order to plant to plant for biodiversity. We need more insects. That's a really big thing, and we can, you know, we could have a whole discussion about why we need more insects. But I think, you know, there's many different sort of services these trees can provide. You know, carbon capture, cleaning of soil, cleaning of water, and cleaning of air, and shade. So it's not as it's not as simple as just saying, well, we want just food. We want these things to do all sorts of things for us.
Yeah, well, really what I think this comes down to is the idea that we are going to use plants and demonstrate with plants that a lot of people care about, you know, gardening and growing flowers in this country and growing lawns is huge business. You know, lawns are grass is the biggest crop grown in the United States. And what we're saying is, look, this is an opportunity to take plants and the love of plants and also the love to eat good food and the love of nature and put all that together and say, how do we influence climate by taking different small patches of land or different forest land and creating these gardens? It changes everything. I know in England, when they did the silver pasture, they had plants that began to grow after about 4 or 5 years in the forest areas that nobody had seen in 300 years. They had some insects that nobody had seen in 150 years that came back after 2 years. So that to me says that we can heal and we can do it through plants. And you're the expert. I'm your fan.
she's your tree groupie.
Yeah, I'm your tree groupie. So I think, you know, that's the thing that we're making a long-term investment. And that's one of the things that I love to talk to you about, because I recognize the value of making these long-term investments. Yes, we have to have some short-term gain, but over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, we can create an economy coming out of the pasture where we're making the forest, and economy coming out of the other 37 acres or 35 acres that already has trees and other plants that are valuable. So it's this huge long project, but what else do we have that's better? You know, the world needs a trillion trees to effectively combat climate change. So we're going to plant a few hundred more and see how we can do.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd like to bring up is that we have kind of a unique, well, maybe not a unique problem, but the west half of the United States is in many cases property that's owned by the government on some level. The eastern half of the United States is mostly private property. So as far as creating these kinds of environments, I think in many cases it's going to be up to people in homes in suburban, urban, and rural areas of the east half of the United States that need to maybe take this initiative. And again, what we're doing is trying to create something, you know, where the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts, you know?
Yeah. Well, and if we think about it, the real value is that besides it's going to impact climate change, maybe for the first time, people like you who are studying this and will be experts can come back to people that own forest land and say, we can show you how to make this land earn you a living without cutting down every tree. We can show you what to do, and we can help you make that happen. And I think there are groups happening. There's a group called Ohio Women Owning Woodlands, and they have emerged, and mostly they're people in natural resources working for the government, but they are trying to show women how to propagate oaks, different kinds of oaks, because there's a real issue around oak trees being depleted. And they're teaching lots of us about how the forest works, how the trees work together, how specific kinds of trees like oak trees contribute. And I think we have to just do a whole lot more of that if we want to see the world be there for our grandchildren and their children.
Well, Chad, I was wondering, you were mentioning about climate change, and it strikes me when we had some discussions about the current business model for large-scale farms. And do you see that being something that will absolutely have to change or adapt? And is this one of those ways of doing so, so that the traditional corn, soybean, and wheat farmers can participate in the benefits of this?
Ouch.
That's what I was thinking.
So this is the thing, I don't know if I can answer that question directly. I think humans, we're going to have to do something, regarding climate breakdown. And I think that these agroforestry techniques could be tools in the tool shed that could help with that. Whether or not rural and urban people too are going to take up these things, I don't know. I have no idea. That's like asking, are people going to go and vote in November? Some might not. Do we have to? I mean, again, we have to do something. Climate change is going to happen whether we want it to or not. So.
Well, I think
the choice is ours.
Well, one of the issues is that we have to find some people with a whole lot of money that want to invest in the marketing strategy that says developing resilient ways of growing food, resilient ways of impacting the climate, resilient ways to be healthy. We have to get somebody on fire about that to make people understand and accept that that it's my idea. It's got to be my idea that I want to do, I want to grow trees versus plant my lawn, and how we do that. So we know how we can make people want to do these things, but then we have to get them to have the will.
And the economic incentive.
Well, yeah. And that's the role of government. So, or it could be the role of DuPont and all these other places that are making billions of dollars and screwing everything over. So with that thought, Jay's telling me that we have to come to the end.
Our time is up, and you have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our guest today, Chad Culley. Thank you, Chad.
Thanks, Jay.
All right. Thanks. And we want to thank our Emmy Award winning producer, Adam Rich. And we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully, probably, and definitely told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and Jay, for heaven's sake, plant some trees for a change.
With vegetables underneath.
Oh, yeah. And eat those too.
All right. Till next time. Bye-bye.
I know the stars are dancing in the firelight. Soon we'll be together, all will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed. Come on, see the morning glory blossom in the night. Know the skies are dancing in twilight. Soon we'll be together, all will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.